I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Doc Harris joins me now. That unmistakable voice that you'll hear shortly has been a fixture in this town going back to the 1970s. If you grew up in this part of the world, you'll remember him for a decade-long stint at CKLG that began in 1973. He was at Rock 101, CFMI, then he went over to KISS FM, then over to what was CKST 1040 AM in 1990, then over to CKNW for a short period of time before going to CFund, then back to CKNW, where he spent a number of years filling in for Frosty Forrest, Rick Honey, and others, including hosting his own weekend program there before Sea Isle in the early part of this century. Throughout a number of frequency changes, he's had a career as a voiceover artist, providing that distinctive voice to commercials and other projects. He's also designed websites and web pages. In fact, his site at docharris.com has been online since 1994. We'll reflect on his storied career as well as look at the media business past and present. He recently hit the boards this past November when he participated in a Studio 1398 production of Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Doc Harris. Mr. Harris, good morning.
Thank you. Yes, and good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, nice to be here.
You know, this is really fun for me. That you came, I guess, down the road.
Yeah, approximately 10 blocks. Yeah,
yeah, to my house where I grew up listening to you.
Yeah.
You know, and now you're doing my show, essentially. It's wild for me. You can't understand that.
No, I can understand that because the great opportunity I was given during the time I've been in radio in Vancouver was being able to, first of all, work in the actual buildings of the radio stations that I had walked by when I was a kid. Second was to work with the people who had walked by me when I was a kid and got to know them. Some of them became really good friends.
So you were born in Vancouver?
Yeah.
And then you grew up here?
Yep.
And
left for about 10 years. 1963. Came back in 73.
So you went to Saskatoon, Sudbury, Hamilton, and Toronto. Is that right?
Don't forget Trail.
Ah, Trail BC. Trail. So was it always a goal?
And Hamilton also. Yeah. Hamilton was after Sudbury.
So was it the goal for you when you worked at these various stations outside of Vancouver to come back to Vancouver?
You bet.
Yeah.
Took 10 years of hard, slogging work in weird, disgusting places. Sudbury, I'm talking about you. And it finally paid off.
And there is something about working in your hometown, isn't there? I mean, I've never lived anywhere else, but just to Vancouver itself, I mean, it would be a great place to live and work and you know.
Tell you something funny. I was having lunch at a restaurant with some other radio people, and one of them was Red Robinson, and one of them was George Johns, who was a consultant from the States that I worked for on several occasions. And Gary Russell was there, and we're all talking about different cities we worked in, different places, and Red looks all downcast. He says, I pretty much only worked in Vancouver. I said, come on, man, it wasn't that great.
Yeah.
Ask Gary about working in Leamington, Ontario. You know, it's like Red got to go to Portland. He got to be in the Army, where he was barracked with Buddy Knox and Bobby Bear. That's not too shabby.
No, not at all.
Got nothing to complain about.
So was Red Robinson the guy that you grew up listening to?
Yeah. Essentially, yeah. It started like this. CJOR used to have a thing called Kitty's Carnival on at noon. And it was hosted by a guy named Ross Mortimer. And it was for the kids and all that. And they actually came to my kindergarten when I was a little sprat and showed us an Ampex 350 recorder. And I was totally taken by that. And they also gave us free Donald Duck toothbrushes.
Wow.
I don't have it anymore.
No.
But what happened was, I was a great fan of Kitty's Carnival, and of course the whole family was. And we used to just leave the radio on 600. One afternoon I came home from school, turned it on, and there was this guy named Red Robinson. Actually, it was Frosty Forrest. It was Brian Forrest.
Mm.
Brian Forrest playing rock and roll. And I got hooked on that, and then he was replaced by Red. And something of that manner. I think it might have been the other way around.
Yeah.
But I did get hooked on it because there it was in the afternoon after it had been there in the morning, you know?
Yeah.
And followed Red to CKWX. And the rest is, as they say, phys ed.
So even at an early age, radio was a big part of your life. I mean, it had to be of your generation, I guess.
Well, we didn't have a TV.
Yeah.
Every other house on the block had a TV. If I wanted to see TV, I had to go to the neighbors.
Yeah.
So that probably had a lot to do with it. Lord knows I might be a famous television producer by now if that hadn't happened, but we didn't have a television set.
You did some TV, though, in your career, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I worked for about 8 years at CBC Television. I worked on the Dr. Bondolo show, the comedy sketch show. I started out on What's a Nice Show Like You Doing in a Place Like This, which had originally been hosted by Rick Honey and done out of the penthouse. By the time I got to it, it was in an abandoned building on the old Granville Island. And did that, and then moved along to Dr. Bondolo, then ended up with my own show for a couple of seasons, which was, I think, the first actual music video show in Canada on a legitimate broadcasting station. I'm not going to discount Night Dreams or any of the stuff that was being done by Cable 10 with Toddington. Mm-hmm. It was the first one to actually be on a legitimate broadcasting entity in Canada.
So for this career, this long career of yours, radio, that remains the I guess the great love of yours.
Sure, yeah, you bet. Yeah.
Do you listen to radio today?
Not much.
No, why not?
There's nothing there for me. Nothing's grabbing me. You know, it's like I listen to the news on NW. That's about it. I listen in the car. Now I've got a 32 gigabyte flash drive that plugs into my. I've got sync in the car.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Plugs in, and I can listen to an awful lot of music of my own choosing.
Yeah.
So that's usually what's on. If I want to get the latest hits, I just download the official UK Top 40 every week and have a listen to that. But to be honest with you, I haven't heard anything that's really grabbed me. Not in the daytime, and I don't get up early anymore. So.
Yeah. So what is it then? Do you think it's the technology that's changed your habits, or has it been simply the sort of people that work in the business today?
Well, not to put the knock on them, but I'm just not hearing a lot of interesting stuff. I'm not hearing anything that grabs me. Maybe it's not targeted toward me because I'm incredibly old. But it's which, by the way, is a big mistake broadcasting is making right now. They've got nothing that's really killing me. And there used to be guys who just killed me.
Yeah. And so do you think? Do you think that's the proprietor's fault? Do you think?
Yeah. It's like this. Throughout my entire career, and I'm sure many people in my same bracket would say the same thing, I have been harassed not to do that. Don't do that. Don't say that. Don't go there. And that was most of the fun, and it was most of what the listeners liked.
Yeah.
But when I have a moron assistant program director actually coming into the control room and saying, "We do not flog products on CKNW, so we'll be right back after we finish flogging these products." And the guy walks right into the studio while I'm doing a shift. Radio 101, don't do that when you want to say don't do that.
Yeah.
You know? No, I mean, and it goes on and on. I mean, it's like I lost the job at Sea Isle because I suspect someone at head office in Quebec didn't like me. Hmm. I suspect they didn't like me because I was making jokes about Stéphane Dion, who, as it turns out, I was right about.
Yeah.
But they didn't seem to appreciate that. Because it was weird. Like, the manager of the station was very high on what I was doing. He would actually laugh walking down the hall hearing it on the speakers, right?
Yeah.
And about 8 months later, he was firing me. And there's got to be some reason for this turnaround that I have not discerned, but I suspect it had something to do with being bullied by front office. The problem I'm having, Joe, is that I've noticed over the last 10 years or so, program directors refuse to stand up for their air talent. Somebody from head office says, "Well, I don't like that, and you should stop doing that." They go right away, "You should stop doing that. Stop doing that right now." They don't ever defend you. They used to defend you. They used to say, "Well, that's what he does." You know?
A lot of those people, though, aren't from the radio business, right?
Well, yeah, in some cases, yeah. But some of them are, which shocks me, because they must have been in the same position themselves.
Right.
But no, I mean, come on now. Whose side are you on? And if you're not on the side of the talent, why did you hire them?
Yeah. I mentioned in the introduction, this is number of letters that you've been associated with over the years. Looking at your resume, it looks like it's a volatile business, and you've been let go a lot, and you've some places you've left on your own volition.
That's right.
But still, I mean, it seems like a tough business then as now.
Yeah, it is. It's it's very easy to fire somebody, isn't it? And especially when you're dealing with an intangible, like entertaining people on the radio, because you don't have any productivity reports to go by. You know what I mean? Except for the ratings, which are kind of anyway. But, you don't. So it makes it very easy to go in and say, well, you're fired. Why? Because you don't fit in. I spent a lifetime not fitting in. But the fact is that when I got fired, it wasn't always because of me. It was more often because of others or because of changes. I quit at CKLG to go for a better offer at CFMI. And then I left CFMI because we got a new general manager who didn't like me one damn bit. So they went over to KISS FM, and we got a new manager who didn't like me one bit. And fired my ass out of there, and then and on, you know. The best one was 1040. It actually went dark. We killed it dead. And it was a terrible thing, Joe. I've seen so many things in my life and times, but the head office, which, let's see, who owned that? It was Golden West. So they were out of Manitoba, and eventually, they got to the point where they said, well, we're not backing up 1040 anymore. We're not, you can keep all the money you make. You don't have to send any to us, but we're not throwing any more in. Well, what happened was the place gradually rotted. It's like we couldn't afford cleaners. We couldn't afford equipment maintenance. And sooner or later, and they were still losing money on it, so they just pulled the plug. And happened, I was at some kind of a hearing about it, and I ran into Ted Smith from CKNW, and he said, call me up, because we got a guy doing fill-in for Frosty right now that I can't stand, and I want to get rid of him. So I phoned him up, and he gave me a job. So that was all right.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it was at really poverty wages. So after a couple of years of that, and having to sell my house and everything else, I'm going, my scheme of assassinating Frosty and taking over isn't working out. So what I did was I had to move to the east side, where I am today, in the same place, years later, which has turned out to be a pretty good deal, because the east side has started to catch on.
It's changed a great deal, hasn't it?
It certainly has. I mean, it's like, I used to have to get up every morning and shoo the hookers off my porch. But it's like, they're gone now, and we're building condos. And the other thing is, man, I had a nice place in Kits, and it was it takes longer to get downtown from that part of Kitsilano than it does from where I live now on the east side.
Yeah.
So that says to me that this could be a hot market.
Yeah.
And it rapidly is becoming that.
Yeah, I'm at Fraser and King Edward, and to get downtown now, whether I take the to the Canada line on Cambie or even the bus, if I take the bus, it's about 20 minutes.
Right.
If I take the Canada line, I can cut that down to 15.
Oh, I know, yeah. So, well, the thing that's really cool is down by where I live is a VCC station.
Yeah.
So it's like it's boom, boom. Yeah. Although I don't know why they have that spur line to VCC. Then you have to go to the commercial and Broadway, right?
Yeah.
And then get on the line to go downtown. Why? I think they're planning on extending it or something. I should hope.
Yeah.
Maybe they were just drunk.
So throughout this career, I mean, you've been bounced back and forth, up and down. Looking back at it today, I mean, is there bitterness on your part?
No. I had a great time. Yeah. The only thing that would make me bitter is the fact that I can't broadcast anymore. And the other thing was, man, I never got to finish. I never got it done. And I was approaching sheer perfection at CIL, regardless of what some people might tell you. I have to say that the departing general manager, who was replaced by the guy who fired me, came into the studio one afternoon and said something to the effect of, you're at the top of your game. And I said, thanks, man. That is good to hear. But I never got to finish. I never got to do it right. You know? So he's kind of like, and the murderer is, sorry, we're closed.
So what do you do now?
Do interviews with guys who have blogs. That's one. I do voiceover stuff, you know, and got some artwork going.
You draw?
Yeah, all my life. Yeah. Draw and paint. But now I'm on a computer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like that. But,
it's less messy, I guess, because I've never been artistic. But, if I were to draw, I'd have ink and pencils and pens. But, I mean, if you do it on a computer, it's probably less manageable, right?
Six of one, half dozen of the other. I mean, there's nothing like the line you get from a really good quality brush and some India ink.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, it's amazing what you can do. And I didn't know that for like 40 years until a friend of mine was working in an art supply shop down on Beatty Street. And they were going out of business and they stopped paying him. So he took his salary in art supplies.
Huh.
And one of the things he flogged off to me was a set of brushes that are absolutely amazing, man. It's like drawing with a pen.
Hmm.
They're not stiff.
Yeah.
They give you a thick and thin line. They're gorgeous. Ooh, good.
Yeah. I understand you did some podcasting.
Yeah, I did. I had, during the Olympics or just prior to it, I did a thing called Lotus Land. It might still even be on iTunes. I don't know. With the wonderful Susan Einerson. And we did a tandem show once a week. Out of my studio at home.
Yeah.
And I thought it was pretty good. Of course, I'm delusional.
Would you go back to it?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the thought, I entertain the thought from time to time, Joe, because we're experiencing a quantum shift in home entertainment right now. I think it's drifting away from organized networks, things like that. I noticed that Adam Carolla is doing tremendously well.
That's a great show that he
does. It is. Yeah. And he shows up in a lot of other people's shows, too. Mm-hmm. He's active. But I think he'll be looked back on as the pioneer of the podcast, the popular podcast. I mean, there are millions of podcasts out there. There was an Israeli couple that did a daily 10-minute podcast, which mainly consisted of the guy talking about how much he loved candy.
Hmm.
What? It's true.
Some of it can be compelling, you know.
Oh, it's true. Yeah, there's a lot of good ones. How we're going to pick a winner out of all this swamp is another question. But I think the future of this type of entertainment belongs to podcasting, belongs on the net. It's just a matter of how do you pull it off? What are you going to do? What are you going to do that sets you apart, makes you different, makes you interesting?
And this goes into my next question, is whether radio can be relevant again. And in a certain way, because of the technology, it can. It can be portable.
Yeah.
I can put it on my phone, listen to it. Mm. You can listen to it in your car or whatever.
Right.
But it's still radio, isn't it?
What, the podcasting?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, sure. It's got a basic formatic. There's a guy with a microphone who's talking. I mean, if that makes it radio, I guess that's radio.
Yeah.
But you have the portability is going to change too. I keep hearing about getting internet connection for your car and for internet radio. I still haven't seen it yet, although I understand it is in some cars. But there's so much competition for regular radio now that they're just cruising along, coughing badly, and probably need an examination. Because they may be in the death throes and not even realize it. On the other hand, the corporations that own the companies will continue to milk their radio stations until they're dry. And there's no question about that. They invested that money. But, it's kind of pathetic because there's a couple of things wrong. One is that the radio stations and the advertising agencies are going after an audience that isn't there. Traditionally, ad agencies have always been staffed by young guys between 20 and 35. And they think that everybody is the same as them. And they aren't. As a matter of fact, there's not very many of people in that demographic. It's kind of a slump. And so there's not that many. I don't know what it's two bald men fighting over a comb, you know? It's not really there. And yet, I'm looking at people my age who have managed to hang on to some of their money or, just done well and are ready to buy all the toys they wanted when they were younger and couldn't afford them, just for one thing.
Yeah.
Radio is definitely not aiming itself at a group that they can sell to. It doesn't seem to be that way. I mean, there's you know, middle class people, and that's all fine. But I don't think they're listening to radio. They're on the internet.
You know, I mentioned in the introduction that voice of yours. I mean, that's one of the iconic voices in this part of the world. How does that happen? I mean, did you have that? Did you develop that? Did you listen to someone and say, "I want to sound like them"?
Not necessarily. No, it's this. You see, my brother and both my brothers sound like me.
Hmm.
They got the voice too, but they went into far more profitable fields. One of my brothers actually was the CEO of Gulf Oil for a while.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And now lives in a house that's the size of four hotels in Victoria. And my other brother is an engineer and physicist, and he's designed all kinds of things that he's sold for the patents on for large money.
Mm-hmm.
He's done really well. I stepped into the... No, I just made a couple of wrong moves. First one being getting into radio.
So how does the did someone tell you, say, that... that's a good voice, or did you mean, you know, you run into people all the time, I'm sure, who probably dissuade you from using that voice, or perhaps tweak it for a certain sound. I mean,
well, there's that, you know. Yeah. You've got to be directable. But basically, it's this, Joe. As I say, we didn't have TV, so I grew up listening to radio, and I wanted to do that, so I did.
Yeah,
you know, it's like listening to Red, listening to guys in Seattle, Pat O'Day, Lan Roberts, Jerry Kay, who were bloody brilliant and became friends of mine later,
yeah.
Which is the coolest thing.
Yeah.
And they were really inspiring. Dave McCormick, you know, people.
Great like voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Dave's an amazing guy, that's all I'll say.
Yeah.
He blows me away. I wish he was still working. But he seems to have thrown in the towel at the moment. I guess I have, too. I mean, I haven't been around to a radio station to have a door slammed in my face for a while now.
Well, you can give it a shot, perhaps.
But my nose is starting to come out again.
Wolfman Jack, we talked about him before we started.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah, that's one of the best voices, isn't it?
Well, you know where he got the voice, right? You ever listen to any old blues records, Joe? You ever listen to Howlin' Wolf?
When you listen to Howlin' Wolf, you sound exactly like the Wolfman.
That's, I think, where Bob got the voice from. I never got a chance to ask him. He was dead before I could.
Yeah.
But I feel pretty sure that was inspired by Howlin' Wolf, because he didn't sound like that at all. Well, he did later in his life. It was weird. Wolfman Jack took him over.
Yeah.
But early on, it was just a voice he put on. Toward the end, he actually turned into Wolfman Jack.
Did they say that about Webster, that his accent got stronger as it went?
Yeah, that could be possible, too, but it was still intelligible.
Yeah.
Put it that way. I'll tell you that one that's really weird going on right now. I watched Exodus, Gods and Kings the other night, and there's Christian Bale, who is British, working with all these British actors, and they have all these British accents, and his is that close to American. Yeah. I mean, he has the most American accent in the whole movie, and he's English. What the hell is that?
Yeah. So there is an air check that's floating around the internet, and it's you and Wolfman Jack.
Yeah, not my best stuff, but it's pretty good.
No, it is pretty good.
Oh, you like it?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like radio was more fun then.
Well, it sounds like a couple of guys smoking hash in the booth is what it sounds like. Wolf liked his smoke. He really did, and I think it probably helped form his character. It informed him.
Yeah,
I love his lies, too. I mean, it's just like, you ask him stories about when he was working in Mexico, and you get three different versions on three different occasions. You know, it's like, he's a great storyteller, but he didn't want to, if you read his book, you're going, well, this is ridiculous. But it's like, he told great stories, what the hell?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's what it was all about.
Is that the gift of a great personality on radio, the ability to tell stories good?
It helps.
Yeah.
It helps. The main thing, I couldn't tell you, man, the thing is to entertain, yeah? That's really what it's all about, and that's where we've lost sight of it, or where they've taken it away. They'll have you read liners, they'll have you read PSAs about events that are going on in town, but you're not encouraged to comment on them or add anything. You know, and I think they've taken that away. See, here's the thing that started happening about 20 years ago. The funny guys who used to go into radio went into stand-up comedy and just and never even tried radio. Because, let's face it, it eats up a lot more material than a 20-minute stand-up routine. But, just the same, the guys who were crazy used to go into radio, and now they do stand-up. And they'd make great DJs.
Mm.
But I don't know if they got more than 20 minutes worth of material.
This community lost Fred Latremo recently.
Oh, man.
And what did he mean to you?
Quite a bit. He opened a world of possibilities. I wrote in a eulogy I did to him on Facebook that in 1963, I was working in Kamloops, and I came down to see my family for Christmas. And went around the dial looking for stuff, and I found CJOR on 600. And they had Jack Webster until 4 p.m., and then at 8 at night, they had Pat Burns, a couple of heavyweights there.
Mm-hmm.
In between, 4 to 8, they had a 17-year-old kid named Fred Latremo, who changed the entire culture of the radio station for 4 hours. It wasn't CJOR 600 anymore. It was Channel 60. And they even got him a rock and roll newsman. I mean, it's just like the whole station changed for 4 hours and then went back to being CJOR, which I thought was hilarious. But Red tells me that Freddie wasn't very happy there and came over to see Fun. And the thing that had made Fred so good on CJOR was that it was fresh. It hadn't had a chance to get stodgy. And what you had at the time in the market was C-Fun, which was way larded with commercials. And I think WX might have still been rocking at the time, although I'm not sure, but they had the same problem. Seems like every AM radio station that played Top 40 here eventually managed to pretty near kill itself by running long commercial sets. Raise the rate card. You know, it's like Red and I were talking about this last week, about how you had to really beware of, and he learned this the hard way, he had to beware of any stop set that was longer than 90 seconds. You'd run a 60 and a 30, you know, and that was it. But now, man, here's another problem I have with today's radio. They're doing things like, coming up 52 minutes of music in a row.
Yeah.
Right after 8 minutes of commercials that make it possible. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, that's not, no.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I'm listening to old air checks now, and I'm thinking, wow, that's corny. Not my air checks necessarily, but I go, wow, that's corny. I can understand why this is a dying business, because I know that today's hipsters would not dig that scene, man. They wouldn't like it. It's corny to them. And some of the stuff I've heard, it's like, I understand the spirit of the times, and I know what was going on, but you've got to have that context. I still think I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what's rotting these people's minds, and I'm going to go straight to it. But in the meantime, we'll just have to deal with corporate-controlled, factory-produced, non-free-range radio. Yeah. And that's what I'm looking for, is free-range radio.
Yeah,
I want my chickens to wander all over town.
Now, the back to Latremo for just a second.
Yeah, sorry, I skipped over that.
No,
I just got started.
No, it's perfectly fine. So he, do you think in this market in the last, say, 50, 60 years, I mean, where would you rank him in terms of the voices that we've heard in this town?
Well, I'd say about number three.
Yeah. And then one and two would be?
Red and Cullen. I'm just pulling ones out of my hat here. Yeah. But yeah, that'd be about right as far as pace setters went and guys who stirred it up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love Jack Cullen.
Jack Cullen was brilliant, man. Just one of the nicest, one of the greatest guys. He lent me stuff for my show even when I wasn't working at NW.
Wow.
I used to do a thing on KISS called the 720 Henny, and it's an easy bit. You cut three Henny Youngman jokes out of a disc or a tape and play them. It doesn't take up much time, and it's three really bad jokes that everyone can enjoy. So I ran out of them because I had all these Henny Youngman out. And so I called up Jack. I said, Jack, you got any Henny Youngman? Oh, I got tons of it. I said, well, can I get some of it from you? Sure, come on out. Go out at 9:30 in the morning. He was out in a little mall on Broadway in Burnaby.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. A little minimal. You go in there, he's got a studio wall set up, and first thing he does is he says, "You want a beer?" No, thanks, Jack. But he ran off all these Henny Youngman things for me on tape. Kept me going for another couple of years.
Yeah.
And he didn't charge me for it or anything. He was just a good guy. And he loved radio, man. He had a, that was the thing about all these people have one thing in common, and that is that they have a passion for radio. There's something about it. And I know what that feeling is, you know. It's like being alive. It's like I have a friend who's a former dancer, now a choreographer, and she said the same thing to me. The only time I feel really alive is when I'm working. And it's true, man. It's just living a half-life otherwise, waiting for your chance to go on stage.
You did some stage work in November, as I mentioned.
That's right, yeah. Slaughterhouse 5.
You a big Vonnegut fan?
I love Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was, I haven't read him for a long time. Actually, I got caught up. I read some of his stuff again. But back in the 70s, I read everything he wrote.
Yeah.
Even the book, there was even a book by his son, who had some psychiatric problems and lived them out in Vancouver.
Oh.
Yeah. But, yeah, Vonnegut was brilliant in that he could express himself in such a way that he got inside your head. Short, simple sentences, the way you think, actually. I don't know anybody, maybe my brothers, who think in huge paragraphs. Vonnegut would just dish it one at a time, and it was like a voice in your head. It made everything so clear. Brilliant writer.
Would you do more stage work?
Yeah, I don't know. This was pretty easy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to go on stage.
You
I was off
stage. Oh, I see. Okay.
This is great.
I thought that you were there every night.
Like I was.
But you weren't on stage.
I was doing it backstage.
On a mic, right?
Yeah. I was just an off-stage announcer.
Yeah.
But it went great. It was terrific. And they let me take a bow at the end.
There you go.
They had to give me a prop microphone and prop earphones to show that it was me that was doing it. But, yeah. And I did it live every night. I remember one lady out in the hall after the show says, why don't you just tape it?
Yeah.
And my response was, you can do that? But, Fred, back to Fred. Fred was one of the most genuinely talented people I've ever known. He was a brilliant man. He was a member of Mensa, as a matter of fact. A lot of people don't know that about him. He had an ability to, and I've known other guys in the business who could do this, and I can only do it for a limited time, and that is they keep all their notes in their head. And Fred could just come in, dish out a show without any preparation whatsoever. He could fall out of a car and do a show. He was that keen on it. He was that good about it. He also brought a certain character and a certain attitude to his performance, which helped a lot. He had his troubles. My favorite story was when he told me about why he stopped drinking. And I said, "Why did you stop drinking, Fred?" "Well, I woke up one morning in the Harbor Castle Hotel in Toronto and with no idea of how I got there. Last thing I remembered, I was in Vancouver." Yeah, that'd be a good time to stop drinking.
Yeah.
But, Fred and I had a lot of fun, especially when he was being a bad boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, we raised a lot of hell. But great guy, just and smart, and probably the most charming man I've ever met. When he was working, I think he was doing evenings at CKLG after he left CFUN, he was making more money than the morning man.
Hmm.
How come? Because he charmed his way into it. He could talk you into anything. It's part of the reason he got so many people in trouble.
Yeah.
But just one of the sweetest guys you ever met.
My first experience listening to you was when you'd fill in for Frosty.
Right.
I guess you didn't really get to work with him, per se.
No, but, not really.
But you walked into that show when you'd fill in for him.
Yeah.
So what was your experience like those years at NW?
It was great, man. It really was. I mean, here I am, almost where I want to be. And getting to do Frosty's show was a great thrill. And also it kept me in shape because usually the call would come at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
And say, "We need to come in for Frosty." Okay. And so it was a certain amount of thinking on your feet and a certain amount of grabbing onto whatever you could to use. And it was good training, more good training, sharpened the knives. But as far as working with Frosty went through a thing where his doctors put him on just too much medication at one point. He actually had a bowl of pills on his desk in his office at NW. And it's like, that sort of thing can backfire on you. Drugs are funny because you do them to get a certain effect, and if you do too much of them or do them for too long, you get the opposite effect. You'll see crackheads fall asleep, which means they're old crackheads. New crackheads will be wide awake and annoying. But, so drugs can have a reverse effect. So he had all these prescription drugs in him, and they decided to detox him because it was the point where he's getting poisoned by the amount of chemicals he had in his system. So that was fine. So they decided to detox him. Well, as I say, it has a reverse effect. What happened was he was completely high when he came off the drugs. He was just bewildered. He was in a fog. They took him on a tour of the new building before we moved into the Black Tower downtown, and he got lost. He disappeared down a hallway, so they had to go looking for him. Things like that. So it was interesting what they did, because he was taking his time about getting his stuff together. So what they did was they had me in doing his show during the time he was off doing that. It went on for several months. And they finally let him sit in the back of the studio and watch me do his show. What a motivator that was. Mm-hmm. That got him going. It really did. It's a wood for anyone. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was a brilliant idea on the part of the management to say, well, why don't we let him watch someone else do his show? And it worked. It really did. But it was really funny because it's like I'm training Frosty to do his own show. What the hell is that? But I knew when we had made a breakthrough, because I was talking about some crime case and talked about the guy who did it, and Frosty yells from the back of the room, "Suspected!" Oh, yeah, right, okay, yeah, he's a suspect, that's right. But I realized he was coming back, and he did.
Yeah.
He did, God bless him. The most neurotic man I've ever met in my life. He absolutely was... He was in a state of rictus 24 hours a day because he was so worried about everything and had no reason to worry. But I think it's just his personality. It's the kind of person he is. And I understand he's doing really well in his retirement. He's having fun riding his bike and getting out there and getting in with life, because he used to hide. He's stay in his cave. Even when he was on, I remember being out in Hawaii with him, Norm Groman, Latrimo, and all Frosty wanted to do was stay in his condo and watch CNN. Frost, we're in Hawaii. Join us, won't you?
Yeah. When you look back at radio in this town especially, and you compare it to the other cities in this country, because you worked at some of them, we've mentioned them already.
Right.
There was something unique about this time and this place.
Oh,
and the
yeah.
people here.
Well, I came back full of zeal and fire from Toronto, where we had launched a radio station there that just took off, just buried Chum. And so I felt like a winner, and I had been working with some of the best guys in the business at that station, and came back to Vancouver, and it was pretty good, but just needed a kick in the pants. And we sort of upgraded LG, I think. Brought Sterling Fox out from CFTR as well, and a number of other people who were really good were working there.
I mean, yeah. LG73, I mean, that's people remember that still today.
Sure they do.
Yeah.
It was largely due to the program director, Frank Callahan, who has never been given enough credit. Frank was one of the best PDs I've ever met. He just had this quiet way about him and a great sense of humor, and just kind of let the guys do what they did. Didn't try to supervise every word. You know, self-consciousness is the death of creativity. And if you're looking over your own shoulder the whole time you're doing something, you won't get it done. Or if you do, it's only going to have one buttock cheek. So Frank was the kind of guy who just sort of gave the tiller a nudge occasionally when the ship started to go off course. But he never really, he was not a harsh boss, unless you were Michael Morgan. And I don't even know if that's true, but I know they had their differences. But he accomplished what he set out to do. At one point during that period, LNG had a greater weekly reach than CKNW, which is how I ended up at CFMI. But we had over a half million listeners in a week. I think it was 535,000, which was better than what NW did in that book. Yeah. That freaked them out. Yeah. But, yeah, we were killer, man.
See, and even those numbers today, I mean, stations today don't get those numbers.
Hell no. Yeah. Listen, man, when I was at NW, when it was still in New Westminster, we were getting 23 shares. And now they're down to, what, 9? Down to single digits? I mean, even when we were in the Black Tower, I was doing Saturday mornings. I had a little kind of a talk show on Saturday mornings. And we had a 21 share at 8 a.m. You don't see those numbers anymore at all. But people have drifted away. Yeah. I mean, the thing is that what the radio stations will show you now are percentages, not actual numbers, because 20% of nothing is nothing, right? We got a 20 share. Yeah, but you've only got 4 listeners. I mean, if nobody's listening, it makes it easier to look like you have big numbers. And it's unfortunate because it's like, it's not true. I don't know how it would. You know, I don't think there's any way you could get back to those days. The problem we have right now is there's no dominant medium. And if we wait long enough, I'm sure we'll see one. Something will rise. It always does. It's like the music business. I love this stuff I get, the new Top 40 stuff I get every week. And it's great music, but it's a little sterile. It sounds like it was done by a studio. It wasn't done by an artist, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Although the work is brilliant. I mean, it's really good. Roger Waters from Pink Floyd at one time said that in the future everybody will have a synthesizer and they'll be able to make their own music. Well, that didn't quite come true. What has happened is that everybody has their own studio. But, you see, this is the part that Raj forgot. Not everybody has talent. So you can have your own studio, but you can have the best equipment in the world, but if you don't know how to run it and you don't know how it works and you don't have talent to put through it, you're not going to do anything. I mean, it's the biggest problem. I mean, if you don't have the ability to make it work, that's the part. You can hand anyone you want a recording setup, but if they're going to do anything with it is another question entirely.
So we talked earlier about how you've come out of this business. Whether you have left those experiences behind with any bitterness.
Nah.
No. So, is life good for you now?
It's not bad. I miss radio.
Yeah.
I mean, I still think there's going to come a time when somebody gets smart enough that they're going to say, let's round up all these old codgers and put them on the radio. I think that may yet happen.
Yeah.
It's not going to be like Moses Neimer's Zoomer radio, because that's pandering. You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that people haven't thought about when they try to reach this audience. And I'm not the one to give you the answers, but I can tell you, it's got to not have in any way any reference to music for really old people. You know, you can't do radio for people who have one foot in the grave. That's not going to work, because that's not what that audience wants to hear. You understand that everybody has a certain age they think they are. Chuck Jones put this best when he said, I'm not an old man. I'm a young man who's got something terribly wrong with him. And it's true. I mean, it's like, I think I'm 27 years old. There are documents, apparently, around that prove I'm not.
Yeah.
I think if you ask anyone, they will tell you that. And I did a little more checking into this, and a psychologist told me that it was because the year that you think you are was probably the best year you ever had. And I think back when I was 27, yeah, it was rocking. But, you can't go after that audience by treating them like their real age. On the other hand, you can't treat them like children either. I don't know, man. I don't have the answer, but there is an answer.
This business that went on with you 15, 20 years ago, where you had some legal issues.
Well, you're talking about that woman?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
You went through the mud with your name
yep,
over
yep.
that. You I think something like $50,000 you spent on all that.
It was a good deal less. It was about 20 grand.
Yeah, okay.
About 20 grand.
But still, not an insignificant amount of money.
No, and she got away with nothing. She got free representation from the Canadian government and didn't have to pay a cent.
And so, do you, from that incident and from that experience, because you experience, say, the government, you experience this tribunal, you experience the media's attention, you're pretty battered by that. Do you think that hampered anything with regards to your career and your work?
No, because maybe it did, but I do know NW kept me on for another 5 years, so it didn't have an immediate effect, you know. They waited till 9/11 before they fired me.
Mm.
I was fired about a week after 9/11, about a month after 9/11, same day George Harrison died. I remember saying that to them as they were firing me. Man, what a day. First George Harrison dies and now this. But, I don't think it hampered it at all. It did teach me a few things, that the Canadian human rights racket is just that, a racket. Any woman who wants can accuse you of some kind of misconduct, take you to court, and extract money from you. Because mine was an unusual case in that they didn't find me guilty. I mean, it was just, I brought 17 female witnesses to the stand who said he would never do that. And all of the, two out of three of the members of the tribunal seemed to think that would be a fact. I had everybody I could find to testify for me. But it all came from somebody who had been my co-host previous to that and riled up my new co-host. Called her up and told her all kinds of terrible things about me and freaked her out so badly that she actually made up a lie about why she couldn't work with me. Claimed I pushed her down on the bed and tried to kiss her. Well, I don't do that sort of thing. I'm not that kind of guy, as I produce witnesses to prove. Also, my lawyer brought out the fact that on the date she claimed this happened, I was in Harrison. So it must have been quite a reach to get to her. I mean, the whole thing was absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, it did cost me money, but I came out proving I was telling the truth and that I was right. And as I say, I learned a lot of things. Don't ever get yourself totally alone with a woman who may be mentally unstable, because they can make up anything. And what will happen is, under the threat, I mean, I got this blackmail letter first from the Human Rights Commission saying, you can clear up all this mess by sending us $1,000. Which, in retrospect, probably a smarter idea, save myself $19,000. But that would say I was guilty, as far as I was concerned. I mean, it's like, I'm not going to settle. It's like Michael Jackson, right? It's like, who knows if he did it, but everybody's convinced because he settled, he did it. Well, I'm not going to go through that. And I knew it was going to cost money, but it was something that had to be done, because I could not let it go. I'm not going to have anybody... They're going to think ill of you anyway, so you might as well fight for what you know is right. And the thing that was interesting was, while I got a ton of coverage while it was going on in the media, the fact that I was acquitted was barely mentioned, if mentioned at all.
I did a search in the clippings files.
Yeah.
And there was all the articles for the first bit of it.
Yeah.
Nothing about your defense.
No.
And nothing about the acquittal. I mean, one short piece, I guess, one of the papers.
Right. Well, the thing that happened was...
saying that they were going to appeal it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's how they used to get off the hook. Yeah. Say, well, we didn't get the result we wanted, so we'll just say we'll appeal it. Well, they never appealed it. Of course they didn't appeal it. They knew you couldn't win. But the thing that was really objectionable to me was that they essentially tried to railroad it through and didn't have a case. And they should have known they didn't have a case. But they, you know, got enthused. I noticed they're not quite as aggressive as they used to be. They backed off a lot. Ezra Levant had a lot to do with that. Because it's like, it was just ridiculous. You could send somebody to court for looking at you the wrong way. The thing being, it was a setup for blackmail. Somebody could say, you did this, and then they send this thing, give us $1,000, or settle out of court, or whatever. And my attitude was, hey, if this woman really was assaulted, she should have called the police. Second, she's 38 years old. Can't she look after herself? I mean, come on. You know, it's like I can understand if it was a 19-year-old girl or something. But, man, this is somebody who should be old enough to be able to defend themselves.
Back to The Voice for just a second, because I've enjoyed listening to you these last few minutes, other than the conversation, of course. But how do you keep that? I mean, do you do certain things to it to maintain it, or?
Whiskey and cigarettes.
Ah, yeah, very good. Yeah. That's a tip, then.
It's for all the young people out there. Yeah. Actually, I was reading a piece by some guy, this is years ago, some young feller in radio, and he said, I once asked a veteran how he got had kept his voice sounding so good, and he said, whiskey and cigarettes. What a smart ass. And I was thinking, was that me? Is he talking about me? Because I've said that to a lot of people. No, it just sounds like this. And if it doesn't sound like this, there are numerous ways you can do it. If you got mouth noise, you can suck on a lemon.
Yeah.
I'll take that away. If you've got you're a little bit hoarse, eat an apple.
Huh.
Yeah.
I've heard the thing about if you have a sore throat, take a marshmallow.
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah.
Tell me about that one.
It's just if your throat is hurting, I guess, you have a sore throat, eat some marshmallows and it'll go away. It's never really worked because I was developing a cold, so I...
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm sure...
Well, I've hot tea and lemon's good, too.
Yeah. And the name Doc Harris, where did that come from?
Okay, when I went to Toronto, I was Gil Harris. I had been Gil Harris all my life, because that's my real first name.
Yeah.
And so, program director says, guy who does 6 to 9 p.m. on CFTR is going to be called Doc Holliday. I said, okay. And Russ Simpson almost became Doc Holliday, but I got the job. So I became Doc Holliday. I came back out to Vancouver, and I was Gil Harris again in the afternoon. When I went to mornings on CKLG, after Roy left to go over and PD C-Fox, I became Doc Harris because I wanted a different character. And everybody that I knew called me Doc anyway by this time.
Yeah.
So it seemed like a logical thing to do. And the other thing was Gil Harris was a name that you just forget immediately. I mean, it's just no impact at all. I was on Facebook. This is weird. You can do this at home, folks. Go on Facebook and look up Doc Harris and find out how many Doc Harrises there are. Used to be like me and one other guy who was a stadium down in Washington State. There is a Doc Harris Stadium at one of the colleges.
Really?
Yeah, I guess he was the coach or something. But that was it. And now I go on Facebook and it's like, this is Doc Harris all the way down the page. What?
Yeah.
Who are these guys?
And when you go around town... A coffee shop, say, or something like that? Do people recognize the voice?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Other times they say, you sound like a radio announcer. And I say, maybe I should take that up.
Yeah.
But I do remember just after I started at CIL the first time, I was in a Shopper's Drug Mart, and she said, you're the guy on CIL. I'd only been there like 3 days. I said, well spotted. I don't know how you did that, but she recognized my voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this has been, as I said, as you came in here, such a delight for me.
Getting bored now? Is that
no,
Mr. Planet?
No, we're almost up to an hour.
Oh, my God.
And so I want to thank you for doing this and for agreeing to do this because it you didn't have to.
Hey, man, who doesn't like talking about themselves?
But I appreciate it, and people can look you up, I guess, at DocHarris.com, right?
Yeah, the website that hasn't been updated since 1995.
It's awfully nostalgic clicking around.
Yeah, because there's all these animated GIFs, you know, and there's bad Java effects, and yeah, someday I might... No, I won't. The thing is that websites are so passé now, right? I mean, what you want is a Twitter account, and I have a very small one. Or you want to be on Facebook, you know, but people just don't seem to use the web like they used to. Businesses do.
Yeah.
And it's great, man. I can't tell you how many thousands of dollars I've wasted on Amazon. That guy comes and shows up every day with stuff.
Yeah, I understand that completely, Doc Harris, join me in studio here in Vancouver, and do visit us at docharris.com. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.